Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Oakland County, Michigan, and earned a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and police administration from Michigan State University. From 1975 to 1988, he served in law enforcement and then served in the Michigan State Senate from 91 to 99. Since 1999, he's been the Oakland County Sheriff and as such leads a team of 1,300 plus people with an annual budget of over $147 million. And in 2006, he ran for the U.S. Senate. His name? Sheriff Mike Bouchard. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, a News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're with Sheriff Mike Bouchard, who since 1999 has been the Oakland County Sheriff. Sheriff, welcome. A real honor to have you.
A pleasure to be here. Appreciate it very much, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
So I'm on the couch now. So it all started. No, actually, it's kind of odd to be sitting in this building, the great voice of WJR, right across from the General Motors building. That's where my dad spent most of his career. He was a career Chevrolet guy, 33 years with Chevrolet, and a lot of it was in the headquarters there. I think his last job was the general sales manager of Chevrolet trucks. So I used to come there periodically as a kid and go up to the executive floors and with great wonderment look around at what an automotive company was like back in the day. So I grew up in this area, Oakland County, all my life. Born in Flint, but we moved to Oakland County when I was about a year and a half and pretty much spent most of my life there. Went to school there, high school, and then off to Michigan State, as you mentioned in the opening, and then came back and took my first job in law enforcement there when I was 19, going on 20. And I've been a police officer, obviously, a long time. And in the middle of that, I was in the state Senate, as you mentioned.
What's the biggest thing you learned from Dad, Mike, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom?
Well, I was really lucky and blessed. A lot of people back in the day, you know, remember the show Ozzie and Harriet. They used to call my folks Ozzie and Harriet. I have a very close, loving family, and my mom and dad were great role models. They were very focused on providing a loving home, you know, a home based on, you know, God's principles and all of the kinds of things that come in that kind of home. And so I had nothing but love growing up, and I was really lucky and honored to have both, you know, as parents, and that kind of steered me in the path that I ended up going, which is very much one focused on how do you help other people in this world, that you're given great gifts, you're supposed to give back.
When you were at Brother Rice, you were a star guard. How good were you?
Well, I like to shoot, but this tells you how old I am. We didn't have a three-point line back in the day, but I used to love the long shot and the corners and those kinds of things. Now it'd be a three-point shot, so I think I'd be more valuable in today's world.
You weren't in the Bob Cousy era where it was just that set shot.
No, we had jump shots. We actually, it was the only state championship in basketball Brother Rice ever won, was the team I was on. Lucky to have a lot of great teammates, and we had a great season. Coach Bill Norton and a super team, and we won the state championship.
If your dad was with GM, how was it you decided to have a career in law enforcement?
You know, I really backed into it. I went away to college thinking I wanted to be a physician. My plan was pre-med, and then I was going to become a doctor. I started volunteering in some programs that were focused on helping. You know, as I said, my mom and dad, you know, were big in that belief that you give back. And so I started volunteering in some programs, and some of those programs dealt with kids that were abused or in troubled homes. And quite frankly, for me, it was a shock. You know, having come from a loving home, I couldn't imagine anybody that didn't love or take care of their kids or kids that were abused. But that's what I saw for the first time. And I was drawn to that. How do you help those kids and how do you become involved in those situations to make it better? And so I started volunteering even more with a guy called Dr. Jerry Tobias, who was a professor at University of Detroit. And he was also a psychologist and a police youth bureau guy that was in charge of the youth bureau in Southfield Township. And so he drew me in even more to see if I, because of my age, could connect with some of the young people that were in difficult situations. And the more I volunteered and spent with Jerry and with kids, the more I became interested. And next thing you know, he said, we'll send you to the police academy and you can do even more. So I said, okay. I went to the police academy full-time while I was still a full-time Michigan State student. So I was doing both. And when I got out of that, I was offered a full-time job in the police force, and I commuted to finish my degree at Michigan State while I was a full-time public safety officer at the time.
1975 to 1988, you served in various roles in law enforcement. Talk to us about that chapter of your life.
Well, I was really blessed. I had a lot of opportunity. While I was a police officer, I not only was a road officer, I got to be a motorcycle officer, a training officer, a range instructor, fatal accident investigator, got to work in the detective bureau, was assigned undercover to the Michigan State Police. So I really was afforded the opportunity and the breadth of pretty much every opportunity in law enforcement you can get. And I really very much enjoyed it. But one of the things that actually drew me out of police work temporarily and into the political world, as you mentioned, in the legislature, was there were a couple cases I worked on, and I thought the victim didn't get a fair shake from the system. You know, they come into the system not willingly. They're dragged in. They don't choose to be a part of the system. Somebody commits a crime against them and makes them a part. And I worked on the Oakland County child killer and the Oakland County rapist and a couple of folks that I think dealt with victims in a way that I didn't think was really the most gentle and the most appropriate. So the first thing I ever did politically was try to work on a campaign for a woman who was running for judge, who I thought would also take in mind not just the rights of the defendants, but the rights of the victims. So that was my first really brush at all with politics, was helping someone on that campaign. And that kind of opened my eyes to other things that, you know, while I enforce the law as a police officer, who writes the laws and who adjudicates the laws are really critical components, too. So that's, you know, kind of the path it took.
We're talking to Sheriff Mike Bouchard. When we come back, we'll ask him about running for the state Senate in 1990. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul, and we're with Sheriff Mike Bouchard. Sheriff, the first question I want to ask is, have you ever had a ticket?
The hardballs. Actually, in 1974, I had my one and only ticket, a 5-over speeding ticket.
I think you got that ticket for going too slow, not too fast.
Yeah, I think I was getting run over at the time, but I was...
It wasn't on 696, was it?
No, it was actually on Telegraph Road in Redford.
Wow. Okay, it's 1990. You've paid the ticket. How was it you decided to run for public office? And tell us about that first campaign, please.
Well, as I mentioned, when I worked on the first campaign to help someone get elected as a judge, I kind of opened my eyes to the whole political process, that a lot of people were very integral to what I did as an enforcement of the law arm, but who writes the law and then who adjudicates the laws are critically important too, and that's where you get into the victims that I was concerned about, and I thought there could be a lot more done to help victims. And so I decided to explore it a little further and ultimately decided, you know, to run for office. I met some folks and they said, you know, you ought to run if you have a passion to do those kinds of things. And one of the things I wanted to work on, which I ultimately did when I was in the Senate, was the Victims' Rights Act to, you know, spell out in statute. And ultimately, some of it was in the Constitution as well. I worked with Bill Van Rigemorter to come up with language to protect victims. And so I decided to run for office.
All right. You served in the Michigan State Senate from 91 to 99, and you rose to be Michigan floor leader. Tell us about those 8 years in your life.
I loved being in the Senate. It was one of those things that, you know, I'm kind of a policy wonk. I really enjoy getting down into the weeds on details and how each specific word makes a difference in a law and how you can interact with those bills, those proposed ideas, to make something that really is necessary become reality. So, you know, I loved meeting with constituents, find out what was problems, what kind of challenges there were. Like, for example, I met with a lot of the folks in Birmingham because I represented Birmingham as part of my Senate district, and they were having challenges with how do you compete with a downtown back in those days against some of the shopping malls that were growing and doing a lot of different things cooperatively. How does a downtown compete? So I worked with them to write a law, the principal shopping district, to give them the opportunity to band together, to do some cooperative activities, some different events downtown, to advertise together. And I really enjoyed listening to people, finding out a particular cause, concern, or problem, and then writing a very specific bill and trying to move that like a chess piece all the way through the process into law to make a difference in that particular issue.
I can just see Pam listening to the show, and when you said, "I love to get down in the weeds," she's probably thinking, "Honey,
not gardening."
Okay. Pull some weeds, okay?
Oh, I can tell you a funny story on that. Actually, when Pam and I were dating, she's very much into the whole gardening thing. And I decided one day when she was out of town on business, she's obviously a very successful businesswoman on her own right, and she was out of town traveling, and we were still dating at the time. So I went over to her house thinking, well, I'll do something nice while she's gone. And I brought a weed whacker, and I weed whacked the whole front. Well, it turns out those are some kind of, I don't know, perennials or annuals or whatever. I thought they looked like weeds. Boy, I cleared that thing out. It was nothing but clean dirt. And she got home, and she thanked me, but I don't think she was happy with the outcome.
All right. And it's only gotten better, Pam, since, okay? Let's jump to 2006. You decide to run for U.S. Senate. That's tall cotton. Tell us about running for the U.S. Senate.
Right. I really love what I am doing and did at the time. I wasn't really feeling like I had to move on or wanted to move on, but a lot of people encouraged me to run for the United States Senate because then, I think as now, a lot of people say there's a lot of dysfunction in Washington, and they wanted somebody that, you know, would take a hands-on problem-solving approach that would be honest about the challenges and find solutions. You know, that's what I did in the state Senate. I wrote a tremendous amount of legislation. I wrote the Sex Offender Registry Act. I wrote a lot of very encompassing legislation. I wrote the law that now regulates the three Detroit casinos. And so a lot of people came to me and said, we need more people in Washington to get things done. And, you know, with your experience in law enforcement for all those many, many years and your experience as a leader in the Senate, we think you could do it. And so they convinced me that, you know, I could make a difference. And I also have a very strong background and involvement in homeland security and counterterrorism. And obviously that had become very much important on our scene. I had served at Ground Zero after 9/11, which was, you know, 5 years earlier to this particular run. And they thought my expertise as it relates to homeland security and counterterrorism and law enforcement in general would be an add-on in the Senate. So I decided to run knowing full well that running against an incumbent in the United States Senate's like striking lightning. It almost never happens where you defeat an incumbent, but I thought it was important to raise the issues that I felt very concerned about at the time, and that included some of the issues we're still talking about today that have yet to be resolved.
We're talking to Sheriff Mike Bouchard. If you want to learn more about him and his office, www.oakgov.com/sheriff. Mike, what's the biggest things you learned in running for this U.S. Senate?
Well, you know, I think one of my personal frustrations, you know, one thing about me, Jack, is I'm brutally honest. I think it's really sad how our political system has become such a money machine. You know, I loved going out and debating issues. I am happy to go out and meet people and answer questions head on. And, you know, if people either agree or disagree, that's fine. That's part of our process. But what I don't like to do is to raise money. And today's politics, especially on that level, it's all about the money. You have to constantly raise money. And I found that frustrating, and I think it's sad that, you know, about 80% of your time when you're running for an office of that level, you're asking people for money. And I don't think that's good for our democracy, and I don't think it's good for the issues to be fully debated. You know, we never had a live primetime televised debate in that whole election. I think that's unfortunate and inappropriate.
We're talking to Sheriff Mike Bouchard, who's been the Oakland County Sheriff since 99. Oakland County has a 1.2 million residents, 2,500 miles of roads, a few potholes in there, over 450 lakes and rivers, 910 square miles of land. Mike, tell us about the sheriff's office.
A lot of people, I think, Jack, don't really understand what the sheriff's office is, especially if you have your own local police department. So what the sheriff is the sheriff is the chief law enforcement officer for a county. They're elected directly by the people and work directly for and only the people. So I don't have a boss except the people in the Constitution. So, you know, a lot of people think I might work for the county executive or for the commission, but that's not true. You know, they put together the budget and they have the purse strings, much like the legislative branch does over, let's say, the governor or the secretary of state. But the office is independent. That's why it's the office of the sheriff, sheriff's office, not the sheriff's department. Very big difference. And so the sheriff is charged with, first and foremost, you know, upholding the Constitution of the United States and the state of Michigan and some of the principal duties as articulated by the Constitution. We are a constitutional officer, is to maintain a jail. So anyone that gets arrested in Oakland County or whatever county you're in goes to the jail of that community that is run by the sheriff. And the sheriff has that population. About half is pre-adjudication, meaning they're awaiting trial or they're in that process. And about the other half, typically in our facility, is adjudicated and sentenced to jail, meaning they were after trial or a determination, pled guilty, whatever the case may be, they get a term, a sentence in the county jail for their crime. So that's one of the principal duties is the jail. But we also are a very large law enforcement agency, Oakland County. We have the largest police contracting in the whole state of Michigan, meaning that a lot of communities decide to hire us rather than have their own police department. There's 15 communities, almost between 300,000 and 400,000 people in Oakland County have the sheriff's office as their primary police agency. So when they pick up the phone, if it's for a knocked over mailbox or something serious, we are the ones that respond. For the rest of the county, we are a support services. So for the whole rest of the county where they have their own local police department, we would provide anything that they need 24 hours a day at no cost as part of being in Oakland County. That would be forensic services, our crime lab, DNA, aviation, dogs, the Marine Division, which we're tasked with by the state to patrol waterways. We have 450 lakes, so search and rescue or patrolling the lakes in Oakland County. We run a narcotics enforcement team, an auto theft, computer crimes that, you know, go after child predators. We have fugitive apprehension, court services. We protect courts throughout the county. We have mounted our horses, bicycles, canines. All of those are available to go to any community in Oakland County 24 hours a day in a support role.
We're talking to Sheriff Mike Bouchard, and as such, he leads a team of 1,300 plus employees, budget of $147 million. That's the biggest single part of the Oakland County budget. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Sheriff Mike Bouchard. Leads a team of 1,300 plus people, budget of $147 million, and as such, you work very, very closely with a man named L. Brooks Patterson.
Yep.
As good an entertainer as I've ever met in my life. What's made him so effective?
Well, I think, you know, he's always been forward-looking. He puts together a great team, lets them run with their skill set. You know, he's one of those kinds of guys that, you know, looks for, finds great talent, is always looking to be on the cutting edge of solutions. You know, I mean, Oakland County is the only county in America that does a three-year budget with a lookout much farther than that. And, you know, the kinds of people he puts in place do a great job.
What's the biggest thing you've learned from him?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things, you know, that I believe in strongly, as I mentioned, putting together a great team and letting them do their job. Don't be a micromanager. I think if you find people, you know, Ronald Reagan used to talk about that too, find people that are better and smarter than yourself and let them use their talents and you'll see amazing things happen. And that's what I try to do. I try to emulate that anywhere I can. And, you know, I try not to be one of those folks that are constantly looking over your shoulder. You know, you put people in a position, you empower them. If they don't do the job, obviously you have to make a change. But don't stand in their shadow every day and micromanagement. It doesn't let them have a chance to blossom and really think outside the box. And that's what's, I think, important in today's world is how do you do things differently, better, cheaper, faster, more effectively? And those kinds of things only come when you really let people run with the skill set that they have.
All right, let's go to a huge topic today, the opiate crisis.
Sure.
How and why has it skyrocketed so much?
It's kind of the perfect storm. There's a couple things going on. You've got a price point where the opiates, you know, especially heroin, are relatively inexpensive and available in the street. And you also have a very high content in terms of purity. So those two things have led to a lot of overdoses. And the other thing that kind of conjoined to make this kind of perfect storm is you have a lot of people that have transitioned into addiction by typical routes that we didn't see in the past. For example, sports injuries. We see a lot of different kids that get hurt in their particular sport. And during rehab, they get prescribed pain pills, sometimes some long course run pills, and they have an addiction that forms. And when those pills are no longer accessible, they go to the street and find that trying to purchase that same pill might be $85, but a bundle of heroin might be $18. And it becomes an economic price point, and next thing you know, they're transitioning to a heroin addiction. And it affects every community, every race, every walk of life. There's no one that's immune from this all-purpose destruction. It's a terrible, terrible thing.
Mike, heroin today is at its all-time strength, and then there's something called fentanyl, which is 100 times more powerful than heroin.
Right. Yeah, you've got, and that's one of the things, when you buy from a drug dealer on the street, you have no idea what you're getting. You have no idea what's in it. I mean, even with, like, for example, marijuana, you don't know if there's dust mites, there's molds, there's any adulterations, there's pesticides. You have no idea what you're getting in a heroin, what it's cut with, what it's boosted with. All of those kinds of things could lead, obviously, to incredibly dangerous risk, which is causing these overdoses. Fentanyl's one of them. Carfentanil, which is even worse.
Carfentanil is 100 times stronger than fentanyl.
Right. You literally can die from touching certain quantities and strengths of carfentanil. Even in the air, ambient air, certain kinds of breathing can cause you to overdose. We've seen detectives and undercover squads just in the room with certain kinds of drugs and overdose. And so one of the things that we constantly do is try to evolve and teach and train our folks on how to be safe in those situations. And also we try to evolve and change on how we can help save lives. So on the overdose in particular, I'll step back and say, I don't think we can arrest our way out of this. We have to have a society-wide effort that includes education, diversion, treatment, a host of things other than just law enforcement. Law enforcement is a component, I think, to go after, especially the people that are profiting from this death. But we have to also have everyone involved to try to treat the addiction, to avoid it from happening in the first place, to give people a second chance. And that's one of the things that I sought legislation to allow my deputies to carry Narcan, which is an opioid interrupter, It allows them to actually save a life of somebody that has overdosed. You know, when I sought that legislation, I thought we may save a few lives and give them a second chance at living a life and hopefully finding help. We've actually saved over 100 just in the Oakland County Sheriff's Office since we kicked off the program, once the legislature heeded my request and made it law that we can carry it. And that's a staggering number. Those are, you know, sons and daughters and boyfriends and husbands and wives that get a second chance, and hopefully they get help. But we need to do more. Right now, when we save somebody, we can't tell anybody who we saved. I can't tell a community mental health. I can't tell a court because of HIPAA. And so lots of times what we're seeing is we save them, they go to the hospital, they get stabilized, they come back out, and they look for drugs again. So I'm seeking legislation that would allow us to tell the health department that this person we just saved, they're in the hospital right now, and maybe somehow connect the health department with probate court and get them into treatment or get some intervention so they get a second chance, not just a second opportunity to go to death's door.
I think you had to work close to 2 years to convince Lansing to allow your officers to give this Narcan.
Right. It was a little frustrating because, you know, I thought that we would be saving lives, and we've saved a lot of lives now since then. And so there's a couple things that I think we can do that will save more lives and make a bigger impact on the program of how we can move forward as a society and prevent all these deaths that we're seeing. It's a national epidemic.
Okay. Another program you started 10 years ago was Operation Medicine Cabinet. Tell us
yes.
about that.
Actually, that actually plays into the opioid. What we were seeing many years ago was that lots of times kids would find opioids or other kinds of pills in the medicine cabinets of both their parents or grandparents, and they would take it. Sometimes they would take them to parties. They would actually, you know, randomly put things in a bowl and take the different pills in the bowl. And so we saw a lot of diversion of legally prescribed pharmaceuticals ending up in the hands of kids or on the street. And the other thing we saw was that when people were trying to do the right thing to get that out of the medicine cabinet and destroy it, they were flushing it. And that's not really the right thing to do with it, because now we're seeing a higher pharmaceutical levels in our waterways, because it's still, even after treatment, the residual levels are still there, and that's a problem environmentally. So we actually started the Operation Medicine Cabinet to have locations all over the county where people can drop off medication, expired or otherwise, no questions asked, and then we destroy it in an environmentally sound way, get it out of our waterways and out of the medicine cabinets. We actually won a national environmental award for it, and we have well over 30 locations now in Oakland County to collect those medicines and get rid of them, especially like certain times at end of life. Like if you have a family member that passes away, there's usually a whole table of medication, sometimes incredibly strong stuff like morphine or other kinds of things. Those are the stuff you got to get out of the house and away from, you know, being diverted into the wrong hands.
We're talking to Sheriff Mike Bouchard about opiates. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion. And I'm Jack Rasool, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Sheriff Mike Bouchard. And in 2016, he was awarded the Ferris E. Lucas Sheriff of the Year for the country by the National Sheriffs Association. Did Pam still have you do dishes even after that award?
Yeah, absolutely. Every day, even more so.
Does she let you display that award somewhere on the main floor of the house?
She didn't want my head to swell. So, yeah, it's I had to take out the garbage twice that day.
Okay. A parent's listening tonight, Mike. What can he or she do to minimize the chances of one of their children's getting hooked on drugs, etc.?
Well, the first thing I think people need to realize is it can happen to you. You can be a great parent, a great loving home. There's no profile of how a kid gets addicted. As I mentioned, it could be from a sports injury. We obviously seen it come from a variety of paths. We've seen it come from oral surgery. So it can happen to any child. So tune into your kids and don't expect just because, you know, they're great kids and you love them that will keep them immune from potential problems in life. kids, you know, run through these different issues. All kids, good kids make bad choices. There's a host of reasons why it can happen. So tune into your kids. If you see change in their behavior, they no longer like the things that they were passionate about, change in their dress, change in their friends, change in their attire, their look, you know, just their whole demeanor. It may mean drugs. It may mean something else. You know, there's a lot of things going on in today's world. We see a lot of teen suicide. If you see these changes, you need to tune in right away as a parent, try to figure out what's at the root of it and become part of the solution and help them through those wickets. Because as I said, kids, you know, have a lot of challenges in today's world. And sometimes good kids make bad choices. That doesn't make them a bad kid. It makes them in need of a good parent.
If there's a listener tonight that says, Mike, I'm an addict and I'm at bottom, what should I do?
Seek help. There's a host of different avenues. You know, we have different resources available in Oakland County, as a lot of counties. The community mental health and our health department in Oakland County is very progressive about trying to connect people with resources and treatment. There's a host of different community groups. Like in Oakland County, we have Common Ground and a lot of different agencies that get involved and help. Seek help. The first step is admitting you have a problem and know that there's people that want to help you, and let them help you.
The devil has a lot of vices. One of the greatest is greed. And greed spells scams. Talk to us about scams.
Yeah, we see scams on so many levels. First thing I would say is anybody that asks you for money right now, and it can come in a variety of ways. We've seen scams where they call and say, you didn't show up at jury duty. If you don't pay a certain amount of money on a green dot card right now, we're going to send somebody over and arrest you. Or you didn't pay your taxes and you've been audited, and if you don't give us a credit card or some kind of green dot money transaction right now, we're going to come over and arrest you or freeze your bank accounts. Anything that has that right now kind of connotation to either get into a deal or pay some money or give personal information, that should raise red flags. Stop. Don't do it. That's typically one of the most common threads of scams, is that they want you to do it while you're on the phone or they're at your door, whatever the case may be. They want to get you while the getting's good. Because if you step back and think about it or talk to somebody else, they know the chances are less likely they're going to get a hook into you. So take that moment to hang up or step back and don't make a quick decision.
As we mentioned at the end of the last segment, you were named the Sheriff of the Year in the United States of America in 2016. When you got that award that night and you put your head on the pillow, Mike Bouchard, what did you think about?
You know, I honestly thought how proud I was of my agency and the people that I work with, because you couldn't get that award. I couldn't get that award because of what I do every day alone. It has to be what they do every day to make me look good. I mean, really, when you have an agency that's running well and good things are happening, it's because good people are doing good work every day. It's not just the person that happens to sit at the top of the pyramid. It's a team effort. And so when I received that award, I thanked my team, the men and women that are on the front lines every day, for what they do every day, even when other people don't see it, because they make the difference, and I was accepting the award on their behalf.
This past week, we celebrated the 16th anniversary of 9/11. I watched a couple documentaries that Monday night on PBS, etc., about these first responders. In the last couple weeks, we've watched unbelievable acts of heroism in Texas, Louisiana, Florida. Talk to us about a career in law enforcement today.
It's, I think, an amazing career. I think anybody that puts on a uniform, whether it's home or abroad, if you're fire service, police service, or military service, EMS, you're doing it because you want to make a difference. And for me, and when I speak to schools, that's what I say is the most important thing in life, to make a difference, to do something you're passionate about. And if you're not passionate about it, do something else. Because there's no guarantee of a tomorrow. You know, you can get hit by a bus. You never know what tomorrow holds. But today, seize the day and do something you love. And for me, public service is an opportunity to change a life, and sometimes one of the most important moments of that life. If they're having a heart attack, if they're being held up, if there's a fire, you know, for fire service, any of those kinds of things that people that put on a uniform run towards the danger when other people are running away from it, is an opportunity to make a difference in that life of the person you're saving or changing. And I think that's the most important thing people should focus on. If they have that passion, they should do it. That doesn't diminish that this is a very challenging career these days, because everyone has a cell phone and everything is so micromanaged and watched that if you make a mistake, everyone's going to see it. And that doesn't mean we don't make mistakes. Law enforcement does make mistakes, and when they do something wrong, that'll be held accountable. But the problem and the challenge, I think, in today's environment is that there's 800,000 police officers in America. Now, of that number, a very small percentage are doing something very wrong, but if it's caught on camera, it will be showed over and over and over. And the perception is it's a common thing. But statistically, out of that 800,000, it's not. But it's very difficult, I think, for the men and women on the front line sometimes to have that kind of perception and that interaction. So you've seen in different communities around the country where they go into a store and they refuse to be served because they're a police officer, or they, you know, they get treated in a way that is incredibly disrespectful. Again, when police do something wrong, we ought to fix it, but the vast majority aren't. And I think they need to go into this career knowing it's a challenge on that front. That rhetoric is out there, and they have to hold their head up high and do the right thing, even in that headwind.
As our time winds down this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners, please?
I guess I would go back to what I mentioned. Do something that you're passionate about, that you love, that every day when you get up, you're not going to work, you're going to do something you care about, where you think you're making a difference and you enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, do something else. You know, I always tell a story when I speak to an academy of a guy that I used to know back when I was working midnights, and I'd come in, and as I was suiting up to go out on midnights, he was coming in, and I'd say, "Hey, what's going on?" He'd say, 3 years, 6 months, and 7 days. And I'd say, "Well, what's that?" "When I can retire." If you're marking time until you can get to another point in your life, you're wasting all of that time. Because again, you don't know how much time you have on this clock. You know, every day's a gift. I've lost both my brothers at a very young age. If you're waiting to retire, if you're waiting for something in life, and you're just marking time until you get there, you're doing the wrong thing. Do something you love so that every day is that blessing that you're enjoying.
You're a shining example of somebody that figured out what he loves and does a phenomenal job at it.
I appreciate it very
much.
Keep
up the great work.
Thank you, sir.
And keep that hair looking great every day like you do. I'd die for that hair. So please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn. Believe in yourself.